In radio and television, it's RCA all the way. The Radio Corporation of America presents The Magic Key. The Magic Key turns. More than 100 leading stations from coast to coast in the United States, in Canada, in Cuba, and in Hawaii are linked together today to bring you this full hour of radio entertainment. Your host is the family of RCA, whose members include RCA Victor, RCA Institutes, Radio Marine, RCA Communications, and the National Broadcasting Company. Thursday of this week, October 27th, will be celebrated throughout our land as Navy Day. In commemoration of this event, the Magic Key of RCA will be privileged to turn over the latter half of this program to a thrilling radio demonstration of the latest developments in America's sea and naval air power, arranged in cooperation with the United States Navy. First, however, we invite you to listen to a vocal and orchestral concert featuring one of our country's best-loved operatic stars, Rose Bampton, dramatic soprano of the Metropolitan Opera Company, and our own conductor, Frank Black, who opens the program with a salute to the American flag afloat as he conducts the Magic Key Orchestra in his own arrangement of a medley of sea songs. We now take pleasure in welcoming back to the Magic Key a young star of the opera whose rich, glorious voice ranks her as one of the finest artists our country has developed. Rose Bampton, a native of Cleveland, Ohio, made her debut at the Metropolitan Opera Company on her 23rd birthday, and she has since remained one of America's best-loved singers in opera, in concert, and as a Victor recording star. The Magic Key presents Rose Bampton singing Leonora's Prayer, Pace, Pace mio Dio, Peace, Peace, O my Lord, the most famous aria in Verdi's opera La Forza del Destino. The famous American dramatic soprano of the Metropolitan Opera Company, Miss Rose Bampton, sings now a ballad familiar to us all, Long, Long Ago. Now a change from nostalgic longing to a melody inspired by Salty Spray. Rose Bampton sings Tyson's Sea Moods.
Come on.
In the past, fine radio receivers in combination with an automatic record-changing phonograph have been expensive. Now, RCA Victor, celebrating 40 years of leadership, brings you in its 40th anniversary Victrola, a dream instrument at a cost which can turn your dream into reality. The 40th anniversary Victrola combines a fully automatic gentle-action record-changing phonograph with a superb RCA Victor electric tuning radio. It is available in either walnut or mahogany. The list price of this completely automatic RCA Victrola, FOB Camden, New Jersey, is only $175, which is $10 less than ever before. But that's not all. RCA Victor dealers and distributors are so enthusiastic over the 40th anniversary Victrola that they, in conjunction with RCA Victor, are now offering a $40 trade-in allowance when purchasing this particular instrument for your old radio or phonograph, regardless of age, make, or condition. In other words, the final price of the 40th anniversary Victrola to you right now is $135 FOB Camden plus your old radio or phonograph. Furthermore, at no additional cost, you will receive $9 worth of Victor or RCA Victor's Bluebird records of your own selection, membership in the Victor Record Society, and a year's subscription to the Victor Record Review. We remind you also of the RCA Victor's Oldest Victrola Contest, in which $5,000 in prizes will be distributed. There is a cash prize of $250 for the oldest Victrola manufactured in each year from 1906 to 1925, which is submitted in the contest. See your RCA Victor music dealer. One of the first American composers to break away from European traditions was the late George W. Chadwick. Frank Black, general music director of the National Broadcasting Company, now conducts the Magic Key Orchestra in Chadwick's Jubilee. Thank you. radio won new distinction during the European crisis by presenting a complete and accurate picture of world events as they happen. Now radio dips into the future as America faces tomorrow's world through five sessions of the annual Herald Tribune Forum on Current Problems held in New York. Beginning next Tuesday morning, the addresses and discussions by distinguished leaders in politics, business, and many other fields will be heard exclusively over the Blue Coast-to-Coast network of the National Broadcasting Company. It is in a spirit of service to public opinion that NBC invites you to hear these important broadcasts. Now, in just a moment, the Magic Key will be privileged to bring you the most elaborate Navy Day salute ever broadcast, arranged in cooperation with the United States Navy. Listen for the familiar NBC chimes, your signal for fine radio entertainment.
Of Anchors Away, bring to mind a hallowed list of American heroes afloat. The names of John Paul Jones, of Oliver Hazard Perry, of Farragut, of Dewey. To show you, in action, your Navy of today, the Magic Key of RCA takes pleasure in turning over the remainder of this program to what we believe will be a thrilling demonstration of our country's naval forces, under the water, on the surface, and in the air, as arranged in cooperation with the United States Navy. The ships and stations of the American Navy throughout the world are now connected by radio with our studio. Seated on the stage in service dress uniform is a board of ranking naval officers. We now present Admiral Clark H. Woodward, senior naval officer stationed in the New York area. Admiral Woodward.
As commandant of the 3rd Naval District, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to the Magic Key audience the highest-ranking officer in the United States Navy, Admiral William D. Lee, Chief of Naval Operations, who will conduct the naval participation in this program, which is dedicated to the observance of Navy Day, Thursday, October the 27th. Admiral Lee.
On behalf of the Navy, I should like to thank our citizens for the interest and the support they are giving America's sea defense. In this great crisis of human history, when maps are being remade, it is well for Americans to keep in mind that the Navy is consecrated to the task of preserving and defending our national policies and possessions. We propose to defend what is ours, and to that end have recommended a defense adequate to repel any single aggressor. This strength should spare our country a conflict. But if righteous peace cannot be maintained, then your fleet must be ready. I bring to you, through the courtesy and the facilities of the Magic Key program, the voices of the senior American naval officers charged with the responsibility of defending our shores, safeguarding our interests abroad, and protecting our nationals. First is the Far East, on the other side of the earth. The Commander-in-Chief of the Asiatic Fleet, Admiral Harry E. Yarnell, in his flagship, the U.S. Augusta, at Shanghai, China. Good afternoon, Admiral Yarnell.
Admiral Lee, this is Rear Admiral George J. Myers, Commandant, 16th Naval District, at Manila, Philippine Islands. Admiral Yarnell is ready to speak with you, sir, but the signal from Shanghai at this time is unsatisfactory. Admiral Yarnell has deputized me to speak for him.
Good afternoon, Admiral Myers. We indeed regret conditions make it impossible for Admiral Yarnell to participate in our Navy Day program. We are happy to show the people of the United States that there are other high-ranking officers in the Far East ready to carry on.
Thank you, Admiral Lee, and a very good morning to you. It is now 3:30 in the morning, Monday, October the 24th, here in Manila. Within 3 hours, the buglers will sound reveille, which will announce the beginning of a new week for the Asiatic Fleet.
Admiral Myers, what is the present disposition of the Asiatic fleet?
There has been no major change since Admiral Yarnell's last report. For the benefit of your listeners, the Commander-in-Chief has with him in Shanghai the patrol boat Isabel and the gunboats Sacramento and Oahu. The Asheville is in North China and the Tulsa at Swatow. All destroyers of his fleet are at Manila except the Pillsbury, which is at Amoy. The submarines are now at Hong Kong, preparing to proceed to Manila for exercises. And on the Yangtze Kiang are the river gunboats Luzon, Guam, Monocacy, and Tarawa. The gunboat Mindanao is in the vicinity of Canton, prepared to evacuate Americans if necessary.
Thank you, Myers. Stand by for a moment while we call on Rear Admiral H.E. Lackey, commander of the temporary European squadron in the flagship Omaha, at present in the Mediterranean, off the coast of France. Come in, Admiral Lackey.
Lackey on the Omaha.
Good afternoon, Lackey.
Good evening, Admiral Lay. It is now 7:33 p.m., Sunday, here in the Mediterranean.
Admiral Lackey, what is the present disposition of your squadron?
I have the light cruiser Omaha and the destroyers Manly and Claxton anchored here in the harbor of Villefranche on the French Riviera. In order to bring my command closer to home, we arranged for this entire Navy day salute to be heard by the ship's company over the loudspeaker system. A moment ago, we heard your conversation with Admiral Myers at Manila. Can he hear us?
We believe he can. Admiral Myers.
Yes, sir. Myers speaking. We likewise have heard your conversation with the commander of the European squadron in the Omaha. And I should like to extend the greetings of the Asiatic fleet to Squadron 40T.
Go right ahead, Admiral. Lackey can both hear and answer you.
Good morning to you from Manila, Admiral Lackey in the Mediterranean.
Good evening to you, Admiral Myers, there in Manila.
Myers and Lackey. Lay speaking from New York. In this exchange of greetings, although it is good morning in the Philippines and good evening in the Mediterranean, I should like to add a most friendly good afternoon to both your commands. You are doing splendid work in looking after our interests abroad, and I wish you and your commands continued success. Stand by for further instructions. We will turn now to our own shores. I will call Admiral Claude Bloch, Commander-in-Chief of the United States Fleet. Hello, Admiral Bloch, on the West Coast.
Good day, Admiral Leahy. I'm speaking from the fleet flagship, the heavy cruiser Houston, in the harbor of Los Angeles, where the heavy surface ships of the United States fleet are now anchored.
Under your command is concentrated the principal might of our Navy, under the water, on the surface, and in the air. Will you please execute for our audience your portion of this Navy Day salute?
Aye, aye, sir. Next Thursday, Navy Day, all ships then in port will welcome visitors on board, and we hope many will come and get better acquainted with our Navy. In a few moments, you will hear Vice Admiral E.J. King, Commander Aircraft Battle Force, in the newest and largest patrol plane which the Navy possesses, the Flying Dreadnought. The plane is now flying over San Diego Harbor, where the light forces, submarines, and aircraft of the U.S. fleet are in port this Sunday. The fleet is engaged in training officers and men so that they will be able to discharge their responsibility as the insurance of this country against any form of aggression or attack. Should the unfortunate occasion arise requiring the Navy, it will be ready. Admiral King?
King speak from the XPB V2Y.
Carry on, Admiral King.
Aye, aye, sir. I am speaking from the so-called for flying dreadnought. Not only the newest and largest, but one of the two sample patrol planes now undergoing competitive trials for adoption as the big brother of the 200 twin-engine patrol planes we already have. Here we have a ship, a flying boat, which weighs, fully loaded, some 25 tons, 50,000 pounds. Its wings have a span of 115 feet. Its four engines, about 4,000 horsepower to get it off the water and then to speed it up to over 200 miles an hour. It will do better as to distance than its twin-engine brothers, which have made repeated mass, non-stop flights to Hawaii and to Panama. And it can, of course, carry more bombs and is better defended than are the smaller ships. Lieutenant Commander Crinkley will now be heard as he talks to his crew over the interphone system of the plane. Hello, Crinkley. What is your course, speed, and altitude?
Course 270, true. Speed 150 knots. Altitude 6,000 feet.
Prepare for bombing attack and report when and ready.
Aye, aye, sir. Pilot to bomber. Stand by for bombing attack on leading ship of Andy Cullum.
What altitude and speed?
Altitude 10,000 feet. Speed 180 knots. Report when on the target. Pilot to all gun stations. Report when ready. After gun?
Tail gun station ready, sir.
Waist gun?
Waist gun station ready, sir.
Tail gun?
Tail gun station ready, sir.
Forward gun?
Bow gun station ready, sir.
Very well. Keep sharp lookout for enemy planes. Pilot to engineer, how are your engine temperatures?
Engineer to pilot, all normal except number one, about 5 degrees high, sir.
Pilot to radio, are you in communication with fleet flagship?
Radio to pilot, yes, sir, and also with the aircraft carrier Saratoga.
Bomber to pilot, bomb sight ready and on the target.
Pilot to all stations stand by. Pilot to Admiral King. All are ready and manned, sir.
Thank you, Crinkley. That was smartly done.
Admiral Block, we have completed this first broadcast ever to originate from the Navy's flying dreadnought.
As Commander-in-Chief of the United States Fleet, I have been most pleased at this opportunity to acquaint the public with some of the latest advances in naval aviation as demonstrated aboard the Navy's newest and biggest fighting boat. I return you to the Navy's Chief of Operations, Admiral Leahy, in New York.
Thank you, Admiral Block. From the west to the east to our Atlantic seaboard, we now turn to the commander of the recently organized Atlantic Squadron, Rear Admiral Alfred W. Johnson, on board the light cruiser Brooklyn, who is waiting to proceed with a demonstration of anti-aircraft defense at sea. Hello, Admiral Johnson.
Good afternoon, Admiral Lay in New York. My squadron is at present distributed along the Atlantic seaboard and Gulf of Mexico port. The United States ship Brooklyn is off the Virginia Cape. Our course is north, speed 15 knots. Captain Brereton, proceed with your exercise at battle station.
Aye, aye, sir. Brooklyn's scouting unit is now in the air, searching for enemy planes.
We are ready to receive a report. Bring in number one plane.
Aye, aye, sir. Scouting plane 6 from Brooklyn. Answer.
Brooklyn from scouting plane 6. Enemy aircraft sighted approaching on westerly course. Altitude 10,000. Distance 10 miles. Speed 200 knots. Answer.
Scouting plane 6 from Brooklyn. Receive.
Sound general quarters.
Johnson, another means of defense against invading aircraft are the single-seated planes. We will now call on Lieutenant Commander Miles R. Browning, nearing Washington, D.C., who will direct a group of Marine Corps planes in maneuvers. Lieutenant Commander Browning, take charge.
Aye, aye, sir. This is the USS Yorktown Air Group Commander, speaking from the command plane, now in company with United States Marine Fighting Squadron 1, flying over the Potomac River just south of the city of Washington. Marine Fighting 1 will now take up an attack formation and deliver a simulated attack on the Naval Air Station, the maneuver being controlled by radio orders from the command plane. Marine Fighting 1 from Yorktown Group Commander. Execute to follow. Form right echelon of section V's. Repeating. Execute to follow. Form right echelon of section V's. Acknowledge.
Marine Fighting Squadron 1. Aye, aye.
Marine Fighting 1 from Yorktown Group Commander. Execute.
This is NBC announcer Charles Barry viewing from the ground the air maneuvers ordered by Admiral Leahy. The 18 shining silver-gray planes manned by officers and flying cadets of the United States Marine Corps are circling the Naval Air Station in Washington at an estimated speed of 180 miles an hour. They're flying now in two V-formation groups of 9 planes each. The maneuver is just about completed. Listen now for the next orders.
Marine Fighting 1 from Yorktown Group Commander. Execute to follow. Simulate attack on Naval Air Station. Repeating. Execute to follow. Simulate attack on Naval Air Station. Acknowledge.
Marine Fighting Squadron 1, aye aye.
Marine Fighting 1 from Yorktown Group Commander, execute.
The order to attack has been given. The planes are now turning and are ready to hurl themselves, literally like great silver streaks of lightning upon the Naval Air Station in Washington. Here they come. The section is heading toward our microphones. Listen to the power dive. Section whirls in on the microphones here on the Naval Air Station at Anacostia in Washington. Here comes the fifth. Listen. The power diving attack is over. The attack is completed. Listen for the report of its completion.
Chief of Naval Operations from Yorktown Air Group Commander. Attack completed, sir.
Admiral A speaking. Well done. Various phases of naval activities in the air and on the surface have been brought to you thus far in this Navy Day salute. Captain R.S. Edwards, commander of the submarine base at New London, will now be asked to show you the submarine escape procedure developed by his command. Calling the Naval Submarine Base at New London, Connecticut. Hello, Captain Edwards.
Captain Edwards at New London.
Captain Edwards, proceed with your part of this Navy Day demonstration.
Aye, aye, sir. One of the duties of the base here at New London is to train officers and men in the methods of escaping from a stricken submarine. We will now proceed with the escape demonstration, and I turn you over to our civilian observer, Ben Grauer.
Thank you, Captain Edwards. We're speaking from our observation position at the top of the escape training tower, a giant cylinder of water 100 feet high and about 20 feet across. Just 100 feet below the surface of this water, another microphone position has been arranged to send to the surface the actual story of this escape with the Navy Department's famous Mommsen Lung. Lieutenant J.K. Morrison, officer in charge of the training tank, is now in the submarine compartment leading out to the bottom of this giant tank. Lieutenant William C. Eddy, former submarine officer, now an NBC television engineer, is sitting on the edge of the diving bell, which is anchored here beside me. Before we bring you a complete story of this routine escape, let us call on these two men before they get under pressure so that you may hear their normal voices. First, below in the escape chamber, Lieutenant Morrison, are you about ready?
Yes, we can start at any time.
Fine, sir. And Lieutenant Eddy here in the submarine bell at our side on the surface of the water. Are you ready to?
I'll start down at your signal, Ben.
All right, gentlemen. Let's go. Now you hear the sound of the electric winch lowering the diving bell with Lieutenant Eddy in it towards the bottom of the tank. The water at the bottom creates a pressure of more than 45 pounds per square inch. Before we take you below the surface to describe the submarine lung escape, let me quote a few figures that are sure to prove enlightening. This pressure of 45 pounds per square inch represents an evenly distributed weight on the bodies of the men at the bottom of more than 100,000 pounds, or a weight equivalent to more than 1.5 million silver dollars. In fact, we are using special microphones below the surface because ordinary mics would cave in under the pressure. And now, let's go 100 feet below the surface to the Navy's submarine escape compartment. Come in, Lieutenant Morrison.
Morrison speaking. We started flooding the escape chamber about 3 minutes ago. We're now up to our waist in water. We can be ready to come out in a minute or so.
That is yourself and your two assistants. You say you're almost flooded there in the escape chamber. Can you tell us just what that means?
The training room we are now in belongs to a sunken submarine. When we entered this room, it was of course dry and at normal pressure. We closed the entrance hatch and opened flood valves in the ceiling, allowing the water from the tank above us to rush in. As the water rises, it compresses the air, and our bodies gradually react to this increased pressure.
I see. But how, Lieutenant Morrison, do you know when to stop flooding?
We leave the flood valve open until the air in the room reaches a pressure equal to the weight of the water in the tank. At that point, no more water will flow in.
Just as if you were in a disabled submarine at the same depth in the bottom of the ocean?
That's right. Where's Lieutenant Eddy now?
Well, he left here with the diving bell and a cloud of bubbles just a short while ago. Suppose we call him. Come in, Lieutenant Eddy.
Okay, Ben Grauer.
Yes?
I'm about 80 feet below the surface with only about 20 feet to go. I'm taking it slowly now as my ears haven't quite cleared as yet.
Well, we hear you quite clearly, Lieutenant Eddy. Can you tell us something about your surroundings as you work your way down?
Well, needless to say, there's water everywhere. I'm standing on a shelf inside this diving bell with water up to my chest. The water is pitch black, although enough sunlight is filtering through from the surface to allow me to read the instrument. I now read 35 pounds per square inch pressure, 135 degrees Fahrenheit, and 95 humidity. I'm starting down again so that I can be outside the hatch when Lieutenant Morrison comes out. This will be the first time a complete and continuous description of a submarine escape has been broadcast by radio. So goodbye now, Ben.
All right, Bill. I know you're going to be busy as you go down the next 10 feet to reach Lieutenant Morrison. Can you hear us, Lieutenant Morrison? Do you know where Lieutenant Eddy is?
Morrison speaking.
Yes.
Where did Lieutenant Eddy say he was? I've only got a few more pounds to go.
Well, he's about 20 feet or perhaps less now above you. He'll be with you any time now. I'll call him. Maybe you can talk to him.
Hello, Lieutenant Morrison, in the escape chamber. I heard you talking to Ben Grauer. I'll be outside your escape hatch in a moment. Down 90 feet now.
Okay, Lieutenant Eddy. The submarine bell in which Lieutenant Eddy is now 90 feet below the surface is very much like an oversized pail lowered bottom side up into the water. As it goes deeper, the air trapped in it increases in pressure, keeping out the water and allowing the occupants to breathe. A similar but much larger device would be lowered to the deck of a stricken submarine for preliminary rescue observations, possibly to evacuate stricken members of the crew who are unable to use the Mommsen lung.
Ben?
Yes, Bill?
I'm on the bottom now. Put Joe Morrison on, please.
Very well. Joe Morrison, Bill Eddy reports he's on the bottom just outside the escape chamber where you are. Are you ready to open the escape hatch and come out?
Very nearly ready.
Well, all right. Suppose we leave your broadcasting line open to get an idea of the operations in your compartment. Go right ahead.
Very well.
How well, Pat?
Just a moment. What's the temperature?
155 degrees Fahrenheit. 24 pounds pressure per inch.
All right, let's go. Open the hatch.
Release the buoy. Charge your lungs.
Hello on the surface. Better have Lieutenant Eddy take over now. I'm coming out of here now.
I've got it, Ben. I just saw the hatch open and the escape buoy shot by in a cloud of bubbles. This buoy is attached by a line to the submarine escape chamber, as you know. It's pitch black, but the light from the escape chamber down below shows through the open hatch. The bubbles are dying down, and I can see the buoy line very plainly now. Just a moment. I think I can see the buoy line moving. Yes, here it comes. Lieutenant Morrison wearing a lung and ascending hand over hand up the buoy line. He's certainly a ghostly-looking creature, covered with bubbles from head to foot. Well, wait a minute. He's up to the bell now, so we're going to start up to our first decompression stop. You better take it over, Ben, while I rest my vocal cords.
Right, Bill Eddy. Ladies and gentlemen, as these two men, one inside the diving bell and one outside with the Mommsen lung, as they come to the surface, let me tell you about the Mommsen lung. This is a flat rubberized bag filled with oxygen into which Lieutenant Morrison inhales and exhales through a mouth connection. Both of these men are under terrific pressure, and in order to allow their bodies to readjust to the decreased pressures, they're required to stop at intervals on their way. Lieutenant Eddy, as you just heard by the sound of the steam of the electric winch, stops by pressing a button, whereas Lieutenant Morrison stops by holding on to the markers on the buoy line, which are 10 feet apart, which signal to him when he must stop for a decompression stop. And where are you now, Lieutenant Morrison? Lieutenant Eddy.
Ben Grauer.
Yes,
we're
yes,
decompressing now at 50 feet.
I see.
And it just occurred to me that, well, we finished our, we're slowly decompressing now, and Joe Morrison has just come in. You understand that he can hear me talking in this, he can hear through the water. Now, rather than continue our trip to the surface in this bell, we're both going to make a second escape in the lung.
Good.
While we are on our way up, maybe you can explain a little something about this decompression stop we've just taken. Mr. Morrison is now charging his lung, and here goes mine. We're leaving now at 50 feet. We'll see you in a minute. So long now, Ben. I'm leaving.
Well, Well, good luck. And Lieutenant Morrison, Lieutenant Eddy, leave the diving bell 50 feet below the surface of the water here, and we're looking out and watching a cascade of bubbles gently foaming up the discharge from their mumps and lungs. And now we can just glimpse the lean figures of the two men in the sea-green depths of the water. I'm tracing the buoy line as it goes down to the water. I see the first key compression marker, that is the top one. And now, looking down, I can just see the figure. I can't tell whether it's Lieutenant Eddy or Lieutenant Morrison, but there are two mystic, ghosty figures coming up here through the surface of the water. The men have to come at a certain rate of speed in order not to suffer the ill effects of sudden changes of temperatures. Yes, and here they come now, bubbling up through the water. Here first is Lieutenant Bill Eddy. Fine, Bill. You can perhaps hear the splashing of the water. Would you come over here and tell us just how you feel to be back here in the open air?
Well, Ben, it's certainly much better to breathe fresh air. That's all I can say.
And how about you, Lieutenant Morrison?
Fine. I agree with Lieutenant Eddy.
Well, many thanks to you both, gentlemen, for this thrilling demonstration. And more thanks to you, sir, Captain R.S. Edwards, Commandant of the Navy Submarine Base.
Admiral Lee, Captain Edwards reporting from New London. This routine submarine escape demonstration is complete.
Thank you, Captain Edwards. As this program draws to a close, I should like to thank all those whose enthusiastic cooperation has made this Navy Day program possible. Calling Manila.
Myers in Manila speaking for Admiral Yarnell in Augusta at Shanghai, China.
Calling Omaha.
Blackie in Omaha. Bill Franch, France.
Calling Houston.
Block in Houston at San Pedro, California.
Calling Flying Dreadnought.
King and Flying Dreadnought on the coast of California.
Calling Brooklyn.
Johnson in Brooklyn off the Virginia Capes.
Calling Marine Fighting One.
Browning with Marine Fighting One over Washington, D.C.
Calling Submarine Base, New London.
Edwards at New London.
Upon completion of this program, all naval units involved will resume regular activities. Well done. As Chief of Naval Operations, it has been most gratifying to be able, through the facilities of the Magic Key program, to bring from distant ports of the world to our radio listeners the voices of officers in high command whose days as midshipmen at the Naval Academy are a distant but a vivid recollection. The voices of the midshipmen of today, the admirals of tomorrow, will now be heard as the full midshipmen choir at the Naval Academy Chapel in Annapolis, Maryland, sings the traditional naval hymn, Eternal Father Strong to Save.
Just brought you a thrilling demonstration of the United States Navy in action, conducted by the Navy's highest ranking officer, Admiral William D. Leahy. To the Navy's officers, midshipmen, and enlisted personnel, we wish to express our thanks for their splendid cooperation. To our listeners, let us remind you once again that next Thursday, October 27th, is Navy Day. the United States Navy cordially invites you to visit and inspect your ships and stations. This is Milton Cross speaking for all the services of the Radio Corporation of America. And George Hicks saying that in radio and television, it's RCA all the way.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.